Okay. So let's think. We're still alive, remember, notice. Mustn't waste this precious life. So for this reason, we're sitting here listening to Buddha's teachings. We're going to continue with the Heart Sutra so we can get some wisdom, so we can stop suffering, so we can help others. That's the point. Okay. Let's continue. Unless there's some questions that you've got from your discussions. No? See? Go. Microphone. Yeah. Bit louder. I think the microphone's working, yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's it.
This is my first teaching, and I've seen
first teaching? Version. Ever?
Thank you.
Yes. Oh my goodness, you jumped in the deep end. And it's okay.
And I can see the essence of realizing emptiness.
Yes, you're right. Spot on.
Can you give me some simple advice on how to realize emptiness, what to do, and what to analyze?
I understand. Well, you know, it's a bit like you're saying, you know, you've been hearing about how urgent it is to realize that E equals MC squared. So how do you get to realize MC squared? E equals MC squared. You've got to start with 1 plus 1 is 2. And then you just go. So if you can practice and study day and night, you'll get there quicker. But unfortunately, most of us need sleep and eating and toilet and boyfriends and food and holidays. So, what?
And
oh, and Ron. Oh, very good. Okay. I'm good. Well, I hope he's worthwhile supporting you. So you just got to go through the steps. So there's two ways of practicing. We can see that. One is you take that topic itself and you, to the extent of your ability, you start reading about E equals MC squared. You go to the classes where you hear about E equals MC squared. And of course, if we haven't quite even realized that 1 plus 1 is 2 yet, it takes time. Evident, but there's benefit in doing that. There's benefit in our talking this, even though we don't get much of it. We can get a taste. We can get something. It triggers something. You do that. Then you have to go back to the beginning and start all the steps. So you just keep going in the system. There's a system. So you just keep moving through it. Keep moving through it. So every time you think about karma, that helps you realize emptiness because it's dependent arising. Every time you think about the mind and you see your delusions and see attachment and see anger and you work on those, that's helping you move towards emptiness. Every time you reach out to others and are kind and patient, that helps you realize emptiness. So there's particular direct methods and then all the other things that lead to it. So you just keep doing all of it, one step at a time. There's no other answer. Do you understand? And have enthusiasm. That helps. Who else? Anybody? Well, let's carry on then. We're up to where? We're up to the Four Noble Truths. So let's continue here. After the Four Noble Truths, once you've got all those, you know, the 12 links, the Four Noble Truths, the 8 senses, the sense objects, the sense elements, the 5 aggregates, the 12 links, all these different packages. This is really the Buddhist, the presentation of the various components of the universe from the Buddhist point of view. That's exactly what this is, you know. So we've just done all those little packages very quickly. So I'll say it again. 5 aggregates. The 6 sense consciousnesses. The objects of the 6 sense consciousnesses, which is essentially the entire universe. the six sense bases, the subtle physical energy, the 12 links, and the Four Noble Truths. The next one it says, it's simply talking about now the thing that it's mentioning is wisdom, the attainment of wisdom. So the next list, we haven't gone into the meaning of there is no this and no that yet. We'll explain. We talked about it before, but I'll give it some kind of a way to hear that properly. But we finish with the list. And now we hear, okay, now let's do the no business. What does that mean, the no business? Because it says, in this crucial piece to understand, if you go back, it says, before it starts that list, it says, Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness, there is know this, know that, know this, know that. The phrase before is in within emptiness there is, and then it's know this and know that. So it's not just saying there is no this, but within the fact of there being the absence of intrinsic nature, within that there can't be a real existent from its own side, this, that, or anything else. So like everything, you've got to get our head around the language, like we've been talking, you know. So at least we can get the understand it intellectually. And like we talked yesterday, I think, or the day before, when was it? We just go into detail about how the simple use of the word emptiness, this is a crucial one, the word emptiness itself is a noun, right? It's a noun. And another word for it is absence. So we're talking about it in a kind of it's a negative word, but we're talking about it as in a positive sense. In the sense that, remember, this is the thing to try and get. If I look in my cup and I see tea, well, then I will say tea exists in my cup. We get that. Now, remember the discussion when I look in my cup and I'm thinking, expecting tea, and I get a shock, and on the basis of that expectation of tea, I will then go, oh, where's my tea? There's no tea. So we turn that into that word. So if the tea is there, what I cognize, the object of my cognition is tea. And if there's no tea there on the basis of expecting tea, I will then see the phenomenon called the absence of tea. So tea is a phenomenon. It's an existent phenomenon. Tea is a thing that exists that can be cognized by the mind. Well, for me, in this particular case, when I'm expecting tea, and that's the crucial point, I will then cognize the phenomenon called the absence of tea. That simple concept is the one to get used to. We can hear that, can't we? We don't talk like this. We just say, oh, there's no tea. You understand? But turn it into a kind of a positive word, the presence of something. So what is existing in my cup is the phenomenon called the emptiness of tea. We get it. We get it. We don't talk this way, but we get it. And that's the crucial way to understand the use of these words, you know. So as we've been talking, what Buddha's saying is, because of this ego grasping, we have, since beginningless time, been believing in, totally and utterly and completely and implicitly, without question, the existence, the simple words for it are, an independent I. So we'd never thought we thought there's an independent I. We don't even know what it means. What do you mean I believe in an independent I? We don't even get it because it's so deeply ingrained. So that means, of course, one of the steps is we have to get to know what it would be if it did exist, an independent I. But never mind even the meaning of that yet, and we've been discussing it. Then what Buddha's saying is, like, I believe in the presence of tea. I'm expecting tea. So, of course, I'm going to get a shock when I see the truth. The absence of tea. Same in meditation. When you've got your single point of concentration, you've got a subtle level, and you've been working and working and working away on this, and you've been thinking and thinking and thinking and analyzing and working and purifying and thinking about it and meditating on it, and one day the penny will drop. Do you say that in Italian? The penny will drop. I think it's coming from one of those machines. Well, you probably put a penny in once in America, maybe, I don't know. And then maybe it's like a vending machine, old-fashioned, I don't know. The penny drops, and then you see the truth, you know. Oh, I got it. It's a very nice saying, the penny drops. You get it. Oh, I got it. Oh, I got it. Oh, yeah, I see. One day you'll have that. That'll be your first direct, non-conceptual perception of the truth that always has existed, that there never has been, isn't, and could never be an independent self. So it's quite a shock when you see that. Lama Zopa, I told you this, Lama Zopa says, the fear in the mind of not the greatest yogis, but a pretty good yogi, the fear is so stupendous, he says. More powerful than normal fear, which is based on the assumption of an I that doesn't exist anyway. But this is a profound fear, but it's a good fear. And they even say when you're meditating on emptiness, some people have a flash of a panic. Oh my God, there's no I. He says, you don't get distracted from that. You don't resist it. That can be a real obstacle to realizing emptiness because you can never disappear. You have to have that certainty. You can never disappear, ever. Your mind is endless. The greatest yogis will have complete bliss in finally seeing the truth that's been staring you in your face all the time, that nothing possesses that intrinsic character. In other words, you've seen for the first time the absence. You see for the first time, that's the vivid object that appears to your mind, the absence, the shock of the absence of the independent eye. So clearly in these simple examples, tea could exist in there. That's easy. But it's a good analogy to get our head around the usage of the word emptiness instead of thinking of it as some mystical nihilism, you know. This is so ridiculous, you know. It's a very specific phenomenon. And the crucial point is this. The absence of tea in my cup will only appear to the person who expected tea. You know, this is why this is so important. It's the analogy of the no dollars and something dollars. This is a really powerful point. If you go to the shop where you buy these cups and you look in the cup, what will you find in there? What will you find in there? What will you find in there? It's called nothing, isn't it? It's called nothing, isn't it? Now that's nihilism. But if I'm expecting tea, what will I find in there? Thank you. They're very different phenomena, aren't they? You can hear that, can't you? Nothing is just like, oh, nothing. The other one is, oh, my God, the absence of my precious tea. They're completely different phenomena. You've got to hear that. So the nothing in the cup, which is true, there is nothing in the cup, if it's just a regular cup. But that's not the meaning of emptiness. That's the point. So like as Holiness says, we think emptiness means you're looking inside here for the independent eye. So you chuck out, you look for all the bits and pieces, all the bits of the mind, all the bits of the body, you chuck them out, bit by bit, put them out there in piles. And we're determined to look for this little secret eye in there, this little mini-me that's been running the show secretly. We're convinced we'll find it. But you won't. So it is true that if you put all the bits out there, it is true, if you put every bit that makes up Robina, you'd have many, many piles of things. And it is true, when they're all out there in their piles, there will be nothing left. Can you hear that? But that's not the meaning of emptiness, like the tea. It's the, you will find the absence, you'll recognize, oh my God, there isn't a little mini-me in there running the show. You won't just realize there's no me. There's very different meaning. Can you get my point? It's like seeing no dollars in the bank, which is nihilism, and the absence of your precious $5,000. They're very different phenomena. And the meaning of emptiness is not the nihilistic one. It is not, oh, there's no tea. Not like that. Got to get this. And we're really on the right track. So the absence of your $5,000 is a very powerful object that you've just cognized. It's a shock. The absence of Ron when he leaves me for you is a big shock. Do you understand? So, of course, the absence of the eye here is not a depressing thing. It's a brilliant thing. So that's more like the absence of cancer. That's a wonderful thing to do. That's a great absence to discover, isn't it? Do you see my point? So I should be using optimistic absences. I mean, absence of boyfriends and absence of tea get you depressed. But absence of inherent eyes beyond blissful. So once his son, the Buddha, has gone through this list, now he says, there is no exalted wisdom. So wisdom, exalted wisdom, is the name given to the realization in your mind when you've achieved it, of the realization of emptiness. That's all it means. It's referring to the realization in your mind of emptiness. So in the same way that he's been saying, in emptiness, there is no, and we've got to spell it out, there is no inherent, there's no independent form, there's no independent feeling, there's no independent discrimination. No, then here he's saying, there is no independent exalted wisdom. The implication being in all of these, there is an interdependent, dependent arising wisdom. There is an interdependent, dependent arising form. There is a dependent arising feeling. There is a dependent arising discrimination. There is a dependent arising self. There is a dependent arising 12 links. You've got to say, that's assumed on by this word. So when you hear that, so there is a dependent arising exalted wisdom that does realize independent, dependent arising emptiness. Now, to get us to be really, not to fall into the trap, He then says, the next one is there's no dependent arising attainment of that wisdom. Then, to be really sure, which refers to the realization of emptiness. That realization is the realization of emptiness. So to really make sure that we don't get caught into the trap of thinking, well, emptiness maybe is not empty, he then says, and there is no non-attainment. So what does that mean? What it means is this. One way of saying there is no exalted wisdom so what attainment is the realization in your mind, your achievement of the realization of emptiness in your mind. That's the attainment of the realization of emptiness. But the emptiness, everything is empty, right? So including here, so emptiness, so the attainment of emptiness, there is no dependent arising attainment, but that dependent arising attainment is also empty. So to make sure that absence of dependent arising attainment of emptiness, that also doesn't exist in emptiness. It's not being tricky. We just have to squeeze our brain to hear it, that's all. I understand. Okay, just keep it simple. There's no cup. There's no independent cup. So within emptiness, there's no independent cup. No, we've got to do this one. Within emptiness, within emptiness, there's no independent cup. Okay, so here he's saying, the wisdom that realizes that is a phenomenon. Everything is a dependent arising phenomenon. So there's a phenomenon called wisdom. There's a phenomenon called cup. There's a phenomenon called microphone. There's all these are trillions of phenomena. And all those phenomena are dependent arising in the conventional point of view. And then each of those phenomena has a characteristic called emptiness of inherent existence. Or each of those phenomena, each of those conventional phenomena has a characteristic called emptiness of independent thing. Every phenomenon possesses a characteristic called emptiness of dependent thing. Everything that exists possesses a characteristic called the emptiness of independent thing. Then there is in your mind your attainment of that realization. So the attainment of the realization of emptiness, of a thing, is also empty. So there is no attainment. But then the emptiness of that attainment is also a phenomenon. The emptiness of attainment is a phenomenon. The emptiness of attainment is a phenomenon. Everything that exists is a phenomenon, and every phenomenon is empty. So the emptiness of inherent existence is itself empty. That's all. Can you hear that? That's what he's meaning. Max is looking kind of with his eyes wide. I understand. Me too. Don't worry about it. Okay. Next. So then he says, So this is the conclusion now, you know. Therefore, because there's no attainment, and you've got to keep hearing it as no independent attainment. Bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. So again, just to say, there are conventional phenomena, and every phenomenon that you can label and define. If you're going to talk about something, you have to name it, and then you have to define it, which means what is it? You have to place it in space and time and give it a proper definition. And this is really quite a powerful point, because if we think of the words we use every day, we don't even know what we're talking about half the time, and we make up rubbish. Now, when you go online, for me it's like this nightmare. You read websites and you read words and you just know not one of those words is true. It's really quite shocking, you know. You can't trust anything you read and hear. So here is this kind of relief to think that you're going to state something that exists. Okay, good. There's a cup. What's a cup, Mum? It's that thing over there, the flat bottom container. Yeah, I know. I can see that. What does it do? It holds my tea. I'm not going to believe you. Prove it. Okay, she will. She'll pour the tea. And we will both see it fits the definition. But that's not even enough to prove it. She has to then check up that there's no other valid cognition within our society where we all talk about this that contradicts that. And there's even more you have to do, but that's enough for now. So then now we've established the meaning of cup. See, this kind of clarity is what we have when we call mathematics. It's super precise, isn't it? It's so brilliant. Look at the sophistication of math, you know. It's all truth, facts, you know, it's brilliant and clear and sharp. So here, so now, once we've established a conventional phenomenon called a cup, we will now look into how it exists, conventionally and ultimately. So, like I said, what Buddha's saying is, in this mind of ours, there has been, for a long time, a particular misconception that's the deepest root one, which is so primordially deep that we don't even think we think this. It's just utterly there. This is why it's so abstract for us, you know. And it's called ignorance. Very simple. But it's got, like always, a specific definition. So when you're studying this in more detail, there are other, like if you look into the Prasangika views, they talk about another state of mind, you know, that there's different discussions even of what this root ignorance is, but we'll keep it simple here and call it this one. It's called maripa, unawareness. Like I said before, it's not only simply not knowing something. That's easy to fix. But it's this double trouble ignorance. Not only do we not know how things exist, we have made up lies about how things exist. And that's what makes it difficult to unpack from the mind. If we simply didn't know that things existed interdependently, but we had no other view in the mind, then it would be easy to realize emptiness in a flash. But it's only because we've got this is the real point to understand, because our mind is imbued with the exact opposite, a total, utter, diametrically opposed lie that everything has an independent existence. Of course, we don't realize we think that. That's the problem. That's why it's hard to understand. So we have to argue with the lie. That's the main job. To argue with the lie is what reveals the truth. That's the hard work. That's what dependent arises. King of logics, Ramazopa says, Lamayeshi says, the king of logics to prove emptiness. So, like I said about the woman in prison. So we first established there is a phenomenon called a prison. You know, rough definition, you know, unless it's an exceptional prison like in Norway where it's like a college. It's a place where you're sent when you're naughty. Well, there you're sent when you're naughty to a nice prison, so that's great. But you're sent there when you're naughty and you can't escape. Probably put it that way. And so the point is, when you define something... This is a really interesting... The word function sounds kind of boring, but it really means the meaning of something. What's the meaning of a cup? You can say it's a flat-bottom container, which is its conventional characteristics. But this doesn't tell you enough yet. It holds my tea. That's its meaning. What's the mind? The definition of a mind. That which is clear, which means not physical. Sometimes it's called luminous, which gets us all excited because it sounds lovely. But that's not enough. Clear, meaning not physical, that also refers to space. That's not enough to know what does the mind do? Oh, it cognizes. That's its job. So the function is really specific to understand. Because that woman in the prison, in this nightmare, was able to see she couldn't get out of this prison, but she could change her interpretation. She could redefine it. She redefined it. She said, I'm in a cell. I'm in a cave, not in a cell. And she redefined herself. I'm not in a prisoner, I'm a monk. Now, I mean, this book I've been editing of Lama Zopa, Rinpoche's, and I should send it to somebody to get it done into Italian. You know, it's really special. It's outrageous, actually. It's letters he's been writing to the prisoners, write to him all over the world, certainly in America and Australia. So Rinpoche asked me to put together these 100 letters he's written to these prisoners all over, and so to put them together into a book, which is done, basically. And the prison project in Australia is going to publish it. That'll be available, you know. But it's really powerful teachings. I mean, it's talking about it's all the transforming problems teachings. It's all about how to see this nightmarish environment as good, which from the world point of view is very shocking, especially when the prisons are so horrible and the justice system in America is so evil, in my opinion. Well, kind of not cool, evil. Yeah. So in there, Rinpoche talks exactly like this. He says, yeah, the whole chapter is on how to see your cell. He said, the yogis in Tibet for centuries have been, can't wait to find some ugly hole in the wall and close it over and live in there for the next 20 years meditating. And he said, at least you get food. They don't even get food. It's not wrong to say that. He said, they're so excited to find this little cave. So you can see your cell as a cave. That woman did it. She was amazing. She wasn't writing to Rinpoche, but she saw she could do it. So this is the point. It's so simple. What was the consequence of that? She was happy. It's very simple. And the point is here too. Because she could change her definition of prison, it proves it couldn't have an intrinsic nature of being prison in its bones. Because if it were that, she could never have been happy. So the point is here, another point, they say when you realize emptiness in your meditation, the yogis just have an experience of the absence of inherent existence. Blissful, clear, focused. They're familiarizing their mind with this realization. Then they come out of their meditation and they bop around the world and they see the people and things and good and bad and weather and toilets and this and that. But because they've realized emptiness, they no longer get caught up in believing in all these dramas out there, you know. But nevertheless, things still function in exactly the way you established. So even though when you realize the emptiness of cup, like I said before, this is a crucial piece, it doesn't suddenly mean the cup will disappear into a rainbow. You're going to still hold a thing, flat-bottom container, in your hand and you can still drink your tea from it. That never changes. So emptiness doesn't annihilate things. It actually reinforces its existence. Because everything is empty of dependent independence, it can function to hold your tea. So this is putting the two truths together. We can get very cosmic about it and get very confused, but it's very on the earth, you know. See, when we hear that emptiness of inherent existence of the mind labelling something, that things are labelled by the mind, we then think, oh, you mean I can just make up what I like? No, it doesn't mean that at all. It's still got a function. So that woman was able to make up another story. It's a cell. It's a cave, she said. She was able to do that. But it functioned in that way. She couldn't say, you know, let's say you look at a fire. Oh, I can call it a cave. Well, you know, try meditating in a fire. You'll be burned alive. I'm sorry. I don't care what you call it. Its function is to burn you. Do you understand? So if you want to relabel, it's got to function as that. This cup is a cup which holds tea. We know that. You don't go into the crockery shop and say, can I have a toilet, please? Oh, that one there. I like that one with the saucer. No, it's cup. But it could function as a toilet. A little toilet. Can you hear my point? It could function as a toilet. It's not wrong to call it a toilet. So if you know, if your potty under the bed is your big coffee cup, better keep it separate from other people who want to pee in it, you know? Do you see my point? It could function as a coffee to, you know, and that's why we've got to be a bit flexible. We're so used to labeling everything properly. I know when I was a hippie first, when I decided I'd give up believing in everything, give up wanting to be anything, and lots of drugs and kind of spacing out all these experiences. But it was quite a good experience because I realized, you know, we're trying to be good girls, and you would never say, for example, because I smoked a lot of cigarettes, like at some point 18 Marlboros a day, in between the marijuana, and in between the speed as well. I ate speed as well. And a little bit of acid in there as well, too. Okay. I always got to the point where I couldn't have any more, so I thought, what's the point of trying? I might as well give up, you know. There's an advantage in being radical. Anyway, the point is, I remember when I was stoned, you know, and I was thinking I was smoking all my cigarettes and always be an ashtray. And, of course, you'd never put your ash, you know, if your mummy was there, you'd never put your ash on the table or in a cup or something. But I used to think, well, who says you can't? Why not think of the table? Why not put my ashes on the table? And there's a good thing about that. That means if you get too narrow and fundamentalist, an ashtray is an ashtray is an ashtray, and we can see that as a very fundamentalist mind, then you have a panic attack if you dare to use it as anything else. And our mind gets very narrow. You understand if you get very narrow-minded? You just need to use your ashtray for a cup of tea. It'll be a small cup of tea, but if you really, you could. So it means you can have a flexible mind because you can change the function of things. But this one of being merely labelled doesn't mean you can therefore call it anything. You know, like, let's just say, we could change the label. We could decide that this is called a knife and we redefine it as a thing that holds your tea. But can you imagine the work you have to do to get all the languages to agree, all the dictionaries in the planet, all the people to agree this is called a knife? It'd be a lot of hard work. Just change your mind instead, please. Do you understand? So a knife is a long piece of metal that's got a sharp edge that cuts things. And as much as you try, it won't function as a cup. So you can't call it a cup. Okay, one drop maybe, you might take a drop at a time. So it's got to function in the way you have established it, the way you've defined it. So it's very rigorous, you know? It doesn't just mean you can call anything anything. That's just ridiculous. So when you're a yogi who's drinking tea out of your cup, it's exactly the same cup that you'd hold, but each of us has got a different view completely of what's happening. That's the point, because their mind sees it differently, completely differently. That's it, really. Bits and pieces and just ends, you know. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times manifestly completely awakened to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as the truth. I've heard that the whole of the path to enlightenment can be described in this mantra, but I'm sorry, I don't know that, so I can't tell you that. Yeah, so you should train in this. And then the Buddha approves. Buddha comes out of his concentration and he says, well done. Even though it was his own thoughts. And that's it. That's the Heart Sutra, okay? What I know about it. Any questions about that? Okay. So So always the thing, isn't it, is how to put this into practice in daily life. Well, it's very simple. One time someone asked His Holiness. He said, oh, it's easy. Just see something from another point of view. That's the point I'm making. Just see it from another point of view. Rigid mind, you know, this is this and this is that, stuck, frozen, you are wrong. No matter how many times someone apologizes, you are wrong, I hate you, you are wrong for eternity. That's the function of this stubborn, concrete ego grasping. It is this, and I'm right. See it from another point of view. We all can see that. People who have got a more flexible mind. This woman is an exact example. I mean, I'm so blown out by this woman, you know. She had that ability. She saw prison from another point of view. To her advantage, that's the point. And that's a sane mind. That's a wise mind. That person also means they don't have much anger. So you see, attachment is this frantic junkie that wants things the way I want them, and then anger is the response when you don't get it, and that's the rigidity, the determination, this is bad, this is wrong, and no one's going to change my mind. That's the monstrous thing. And look at the suffering of the world, and we can understand. It's simply called because of anger. And it's rigid in its nature. That's the nightmare. So clearly this woman must have had a patient mind. She must have been patient. Patient means you're able to bear the problem. That's what patient means. You're able to bear the problem. And she was even able to transform it into happiness. Exactly this whole approach, you know. That's a very powerful, brave mind, you have to admit. That's how you apply emptiness in daily life. Very simple. Extremely hard, but simple. Because why? Because things don't have an intrinsic nature. I mean, we have all these lovely sayings, you know. Count your blessings, we say. Look on the bright side, we say. Don't see it as the glass is half full, see it as half empty, see it as half full. It's just exactly the same meaning. But when we're miserable, when we're dissatisfied because of attachment and it never gets what we want, we're addicted to misery. We're addicted to seeing the bad. We're addicted to seeing what we haven't got. We're addicted to dissatisfaction. That's the pain of attachment. And then anger continually comes, aversion, annoyance, irritated, upset, stress, worry, panic. That's aversion. So having the attachment, when it doesn't get what it wants, is the brave attitude of welcoming it. How can I see an advantage in this? It's a profoundly wise state of mind, but think about it, it's intelligent and practical. That woman had a mind like that. It's very clear. Very incredible. And it's to our advantage. It's not holy. It's practical. Stops you from going mad. That's how you apply emptiness in daily life. But it takes courage, you know. Because this junkiness wants what it wants. So you could also say that's an optimistic state of mind. It's optimistic. So let's look at this, unpack a little bit this idea of these so-called eight worldly dharmas, which is all part of this particular approach, this more advanced approach of learning to see the world differently as a method for smashing all the misconceptions. So like I said, one we discussed in the very beginning stages, in the high school level, where we start looking to our mind, we start to go into the way attachment functions. Then attachment gives rise to aversion. So we go back and forth between these two. But another way of putting it here, in the eight worldly dharmas, just four pairs of things, Attachment actually is continuously there. So I said the example, when I'm walking back to my room, let's say, and it's very, the wind is very cold. If I'm in the room, my attachment is getting what it wants, a pleasant temperature. So you're content. So then as soon as I walk out the door and hit the cold wind, instantly attachment doesn't get what it wants, right? Because it's the cold wind. And you, so what happens is, the other way to put it here is, that attachment, instead of now attachment constantly wanting to be wanting to maintain the warmth, now attachment shifts its focus onto how to stop the unhappy thing. So attachment is continuous. You have attachment to get the warmth, and keep it when you've got it. And then you now change the attachment to being free of the cold. And that brings in all the anticipation. So I know my walk is about 1 minute. So you can handle it. You can manage. But the second you feel the cold, what kicks in instantly, the feeling arises. Remember, unpleasant feeling on the skin. This is the tactile consciousness. An unpleasant feeling. Why? Because you're attached to warmth. So as soon as the cold comes, attachment immediately stops getting what it wants, and then aversion arises. But now attachment kicks in too, and now is anticipating or trying to get free of that unpleasant feeling. Like when I had those arthritic pains I had. What sustained me in the pain was knowing it would stop. They usually lasted 36 hours, and that's when I would think of the people who couldn't stop their pain, and I was just kind of blown out by that. Because attachment, part of its function is to hold on to what we've got, but to also anticipate something new. And we spend much of our time doing that. When you're not getting what you want, you spend all your attachment on anticipating and finding and manipulating and controlling to get what you want. So it never ends, you know. So here, the practice is, again, it's very simple. This is practicing patience, but practicing emptiness too. Like with the woman in the prison. Many of my friends in prison who are in garbage dump places, and it is not comfortable, and they're totally, continuously miserable, especially those who can't anticipate getting out of prison. So they just stay profoundly depressed because literally they have nothing to look forward to and they don't know how to change their mind. I mean, I know many friends. I've been writing to some people for like 25 years, and I can think of, just think of two, for example, if I compare. One of them is the sweetest man in the world who's on death row in Michigan. Then 20 years ago, the governor cancelled death row. So they all then reverted to a life sentence. I've known him for a long time. He's a very sweet person, but he's always depressed, always worried, always hoping he'll get out, always looking forward to it, always anticipating, thinking about what he hasn't got. I mean, excuse me, we understand we're all the same. This is how we live our lives. Because he loves the Buddhist things, he's very sweet, he's kind to people, he's amazing. He takes care of all the old guys dying, you know, in feeding them and everything. He's very kind, but he's kind of always sad, always, because he's in prison, always hoping he'll find a lawyer, hoping he'll find someone to help him get out of prison. He has been in there since he's 19. He was in a gang. Somebody died. There's a young black guy in Michigan, somewhere, Illinois, somewhere, I forget. And now he's 45, 50, getting on for 50. Still sad. Because, I mean, so it shows how he's a kind person, a dear person, but doesn't know how to really learn. Like my friend Mitch is different. Mitch in Kentucky. He's really satisfied. He's content with his life. He's truly content. And he does everything he can to help everybody else. He's funny. He works hard at his practice. He makes things for people. He looks after his mummy and his daddy and his grandchildren. He's just a dear, he's content. So contentment sounds sort of like a boring quality, but it's a very profound quality. And they're both in prison. Mitch is on death row. He's getting close to his death. So there's another one. He can't change his mind, you know, just sad. We understand. We're all like it. Look at us. And this is a tragedy. We can see this. If we look objectively at some people's lives, just an objective analysis, you could say that my friend, James, this other one, his objective reality is horrible. garbage food, not very nice roommates, not a pleasant, no sensory pleasure, not much choice what you do. So it is objectively, you know, not very nice. And then we know some people, if you look at it objectively, have lots of money in the bank, they're beautiful, they have gorgeous family. Forget James, I can think of Mitch, who's content, who's happy, who's kind, who's funny, who's compassionate, who's accepting his death, accepting his reality, accepted a long time ago. So he's content and fulfilled and kind and compassionate. And he's in this, this prison in Kentucky is horrible. You know, this old Victorian building that's boiling hot in the summer and freezing cold in the winter. Really, really old and ugly. But he's content. And then we see people who've got beautiful house, beautiful this, beautiful body, beautiful money, beautiful family, beautiful, and that we know. I mean, depression is one of the commonest sufferings we have in our culture. And they are beyond despair and misery and complaining. And we all know this, but we don't quite join the dots and don't see what the cause is. It's because of attachment and inability to change their mind. This is the world. So, I mean, it's easy to say the words change your mind, but we know how difficult it is. So clear. Happiness does not come from the objects. It's so evident when you think like that, you know. So we need to learn when attachment doesn't get what it wants, is the point in terms of this part of transforming problems. So the minute the cold air hits my skin, the practice is to go, great, this is delicious. Of course you don't believe it in the beginning. Like the woman in prison, you know, I'm in a cave. Change your interpretation of it. Another approach to it as well, which is helping you understand about karma and purification. I think I mentioned a friend of mine, Roger, Australian monk, not Lama Zopa's Roger, another one, meditator, 30 years, 40 years, serious meditation retreats, 3 years, 4 years, back and forth, you know. And at some point, out of his brain, with rage and despair and arrogance, he was kind of really scared, you know, I mean, really distressed. Went to Rinpoche, and Rinpoche laughed. I said, laughed and laughed. Fantastic. The dirt has to come out. The dirt has to come out. The dirt has to come out. So we can understand this idea of purification. So we kind of understand it. If you go to the gym and you hear and you see photos of people who've turned, you know, lost 20 kilos and look gorgeous, go, oh, wow, I'd love to be like that. Go to the gym helps. Oh, go to the gym. Well, the first day you come home, you can't believe how many, you've discovered muscles you never knew you had. I mean, is it not true? You have felt, you've never felt this bad. But the interesting point is, you don't have a panic attack and go to the doctor, do you? You know the pain is a good sign. It's so obvious. When you go on a fast or you start eating good food, you know, your breath smells, you get little burps and, you know, but you know it's a good sign. The dirt is coming out. We get it when it comes to the body, but never when it comes to emotions because we're so fragile, because we're frantic to feel good all the time. We're desperate like babies, you know. We can't cope with unpleasant feelings. It's not being horrible about us. It's a profound disease we've got. So we have to practice interpreting it differently. So one way, if you're a Buddhist, and these are, I mean, your question. What's your name again, back there? Yours, darling, yeah. Julia. Oh, you're Julia, yeah. Another Julia. No, yeah, you're the Julia. You were here, weren't you? No, you're Julia too. No, it's okay. Don't worry about it. Cancel. I'm just confusing things. Okay, so Julia's point about how do you live with pain. I mean, we can see how intense that is. So let's just start with the baby examples. When your knee hurts, when the cold hits your skin. I mean, excuse me, we're not going to die. So why not practice on the small things? Don't wait till you get to death row. Don't wait till your husband leaves you. Don't wait till you get cancer to do this. This is a really simple point. We don't have to invite problems to come. We know they're going to come like rain. So be ready for them. Do you understand? Practice the little baby thing of a slight temperature change instead of having a distress. And we just take it for natural. Oh, it's cold. Oh, God, I'm cold. I can't wait to my heater. Little baby things like that. Change your mind there. Get used to it. And it's profound. So see it as purification as well. Because every time, you see, every time the technology of karma, every millisecond of happy feelings is a fruit of a past virtue. Every millisecond of unpleasant feelings is the fruit of a past non-virtue. So, but necessarily, every time an unpleasant feeling arises, you've just finished that fruit. You've just finished that seed. That's called purification. So go, wow, great. Just finished that negative karma. That is, if you have the view of karma, which might be difficult for us, but if we do have, it's a very logical interpretation. So it's a very powerful method to help you bear the problems. And this is the point that I was saying to Julia, which is hard to see, that the main pain we have is because of the mental attitude, because of attachment and aversion. This sounds very shocking to us. It's our interpretation of it. This is shocking to hear. So we can change our interpretation. That's transforming problems into happiness. So with intense experiences, it just takes time. And this is what I'm even saying. All the doctors and people now even are doing this, learning methods of trying to find the way to see your pain differently. It's so intelligent. To wait for just do it with the little pains, the little examples, the little things that go wrong. So it's both seeing it as not having an inherent nature and delighting in it, because if it's a moment of unhappiness, it's the fruit of a non-virtue, so you've just finished it. That's a very powerful logic. The dirt has to come out, as Rinpoche said. The dirt has to come out. So in exactly the same way, when you come home from the gym, I know when I used to do martial arts, you know, I'd train 6 days a week, 3 hours a day. I'd come home absolutely exhausted, but my mind was so happy. Isn't it? But you know, normally when you get tired, you know when we get tired from working, we can't cope. And this is where it's so interesting. One is the body is tired. Who says your mind's got to be distressed? But we just assume because that's the trouble. Because the body is tired, so it's an unpleasant feeling. Because we've never questioned it, we just assume, now I'm stressed. We assume, because you have an unhappy experience in your body, that you're going to be mentally distressed. That's the liberation when you realize you can change your mind and decide to think differently. We don't have to do it in some situations. When you're in love with somebody, you'll sit up, I'll sit up all night talking to Ron. When we're attached, won't we? And you go to work next morning completely blissful. Isn't this true? It proves that tiredness is your interpretation of it. Even tiredness is the interpretation of it, you know. It's so obvious. We should be embarrassed, you know. So we just take all this for granted. So we're aware of our mind. We can change our mind. See things that we would normally think as not good as good, you know, and see its purification. So we can do these things. It's a skillful means and it's intelligent. And, you know, Buddha didn't invent this stuff. He's not a creator. I just think he's very good at it, that's all. He's got lots of good methods, you know. And every time think, why are you doing this? It's not moralistic. It's practical. The conclusion is that you get happy. And, of course, the long term, you're purifying your karma. The Buddha's view. And then, of course, it helps you become compassionate for others because your heart is opening, you know. When your mind is rigid with your own unhappiness and your own attachment and own aversion, you can't see past your own nose. You're just locked in your own misery. But if you start to lessen your own misery by lessening your attachment and lessening your anger, your heart becomes more open. You naturally get closer to others, and that's the beginning of compassion, isn't it? It's very clear. That's why compassion on its own is not enough, as His Holiness says. As Lama Zopa says, meaning well is not enough. You need wisdom. Wisdom comes every time we work on our mind. Mm, 5:30. Bit early for a break, I think. Oh. I forget. Oh, 6:30. We've got till 6:30 tonight, not 7:30. Oh, I see. Today's Friday, right, or Saturday?
Saturday.
Oh, Saturday.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I forgot. Yeah, until 7:30, dinner. That's it. Teachings, dinner, dinner at 8, okay. Okay, any questions, people? I mean, any questions? Please. Yes. Yes, Julia.
I have a question about purification.
Yes.
When I met Lama Zopa, he told me, as the same way to say, that it's good that you have pain, you have a disease, etc.
Yes. And how do you feel about that?
And then, exactly, I don't, sometimes, it's difficult for me to keep the middle way.
Of course it is.
Because sometimes you can get very, can go very far, kind of Catholicism, and you are out of that, you're letting, it's so good that I'm and then to be happy about it. So it's difficult for me to manage.
So tell us, this is a good point. So go into more detail about what is makes it difficult for you. Tell me about it. Say it a bit more, because it's a very common experience. So talk about it.
For me, it's difficult to accept that such a suffering, that's fortunate I had less and less, is purifies me. It's difficult for me to think as well.
Okay, good. Okay. Oh, I see. So karma is a hard one for you. Other lives is a hard one for you. Is that what you're saying?
For me,
to accept karma.
To accept the pain
is the result of a negative action.
No, this I can accept, but it's difficult for me to accept the pain in order to get a future life, because sometimes the pain is stronger and I just think about my present life.
Of course you do. We all do. I mean, this is quite, I know this idea of future life is, I know, of course it is. Of course it is, darling. Of course it is. Of course it is. This is completely normal. But let me ask you a question first. So you're saying you don't dislike the view of continuity of consciousness and karma. That fits for you. That's okay.
Very much.
Okay, good. So then at least theoretically it makes sense to you.
Yes.
So there's two things, isn't it? This is where I think it takes time. There's two things. One is, if we've got this confidence in the path, and the continuity of consciousness, karma, reincarnation, that's got to be the ground in which we begin our practice and grow our practice from this perspective. So then, okay, so then we know theoretically that, you know, the technology of happiness and suffering is that happiness is the fruit of past virtue, and unhappiness and suffering is the fruit of past non-virtue. In other words, negative actions cause suffering and positive actions cause happiness. So, of course, the big problem there, as I've just said before, we are completely, as soon as we hear that, like Max's point, we can't help but hear it as punishment. That's what you just said, you know. So that's how we hear it, and that's part of the misery for us. And then we go, oh, I must be a bad person. This is the thoughts that we go through. This is very automatic, because this is the function of ego grasping, to think this dualistic view, to have this view of punishment, reward, bad, good. We've made up that view. So we shouldn't blame our Catholic mummies or our Jewish mummies. This is just the way ego works. That's where, when we catch that, we then have to argue with it and be very clear. Okay, what does karma mean? That's why I say 27 times, Buddha is not a creator. Buddha is not a punisher. Buddha is not a rewarder. Karma is a natural law. No one made it up. No one's running it. Because that's how we hear it. It's very deep in our bones. So we just have to keep being clear with ourselves and catch those neurotic feelings. Then be logical and argue with them. So then more theoretical, at least then begin to understand the theories, and then slowly, slowly by practicing, it just becomes like anything. We all know there's a lovely saying in English, it may be the same in Italian, practice makes perfect. Do you say that? Well, a lovely way Tibetans say it. They say, nothing gets more difficult with practice. That's an interesting take on it, isn't it? Nothing ever gets more difficult with practice. That's a more humble way of putting it, you know. That's very helpful. But the trouble is, you see, Julia, and this is the point where we understand this business of feeling, we either have pleasant feelings or unpleasant feelings. And then because we have attachment, the junkie in us, whose job it is to find the things that will give pleasant feeling. And it's a very exhausting job when all you do is keep finding things that bring unpleasant feelings. And because basically we can't stand unpleasant feelings and we only want pleasant feelings. And the we in there really is attachment. And we're junkies for that, and that's why we're so distressed. So it's easy to, of course it's hard when a bad feeling comes to think it's good. It sounds like hilarious. It sounds like, what are you talking about? It sounds like you just said, whip, whip, I'm a bad person, I deserve it. But we've got to really be cautious with the thoughts we have and really interpret it very cleanly. That helps the mind a lot. Meanwhile, you know, I remember one time when I first got to Kopan. I'd met the lamas in Australia the year before, and I came to Kopan. I was going to become a nun, and I was trying to be a good Buddhist, and all of my interpretations of it. And I remember I got diarrhea or something, which is very common in Tibet. And I was lying. I thought, I shouldn't have a pill. I've got to suffer with this karma, you know. And I was very sick and miserable. I was really sick. And the lama saw me. He said, "Take a pill." So I thought, "Oh, that's an easy thing to do. Take a pill." I mean, I thought, oh, I had to suffer. I'm bad. I've got to suffer. You know, it was like ridiculous view. He just said, excuse me, take a pill. So if you can take a painkiller, baby, take a painkiller. But if you can't, maybe that's when the practice starts, you know. Do you understand? So we get guilty and start feeling all fundamentalist with ourselves. I'm supposed to suffer. It's rubbish to talk this way. But if, especially when we can't change it, like the prison, she didn't have a choice. And if you've got pain all the time, you don't have a choice. Do you understand? And that's why when we do have a little choice, like the cold air, grab it and try and see it as good, and then it gets you ready for the big things. But the other thing is because, you see, we have no patience either because we, you know, we understand, for example, that if you're growing a garden, I always think it's a great analogy. You know, if you've got a big mass of overgrown green stuff out there with these big weeds and all entangled, it's a total mess. So then you've got to start working on your garden. Well, you know you've got to pull out all these weeds. It's exhausting before you even begin to grow the flowers. So once you understand the process of growing a garden, and once you've got the vision of what your garden will look like in the future, that encourages you. And then when you go out there one day and you're pulling out all the weeds and you're covered in dirt, and I look at you and I think, God, and you're smiling. I think, what are you smiling for? You're such a mess. Oh, no, I'm doing the work. I'm so happy. I'm moving towards my beautiful garden. Then we understand the same here, or the same with the gym. You come home just as fat as ever with pain. But you're happy. So it's that, you know. But our trouble is attachment's a junkie that wants happiness now. And this is our big trouble. We confuse that happy feeling where, oh, well, everything must be good. It's a lie, you know. So we've really got to be intelligent how we interpret everything. And we've got to have patience. And there's nothing wrong with anticipating the end result. That's what gives us enthusiasm. We'll talk about the six perfections later. We've got a later, haven't we? Have we got later? No later. Oh, that's today, but we've got tomorrow. Oh, in the morning. We're okay. We'll do something. We'll talk about the six perfections tomorrow, okay? Yeah. Okay. So we've got to really practice having this. It's like we've got a map. We're not used to thinking we have a map. But if we look at this lamb room and we've got confidence in this path, the Tibetan Buddhist path, it's our path, let's say. Not saying you have to have it as your path, but if it is, let's say, and we know the way to map it all out, beginning to end, this level, then it goes to there, then it goes to there. That's quite consoling in a way. I mean, you think about it. If you've got to, you know, even just drive to an hour away, to Pisa, think about this. If you didn't have a map, you could drive for weeks getting lost, couldn't you? Think about that. And you'd be so distressed because you never know where you're going and you never know where you've come from and you never know where you are. That's very depressing. But if you've got to drive to Australia and you've got a map, you don't care how long it takes because you can track your journey. You know where you are. A map is a very powerful concept. So this is what they say here, this lamb rim is this map. Even if you're studying to become a doctor and it's going to take you 7 years, you've got a map. So you can... You know where you're going and you can take your progress as you go and still anticipate the result. But it's a job in movement, you know. So it's very helpful to think that way. So there's nothing wrong with anticipating getting better. understanding problems, understanding emptiness, and encourage yourself by anticipating it, looking forward to it. But meanwhile, enjoy the journey as well. But the trouble is, we are junkies for good feelings. And that's what misleads us hugely. So we assume, because I have a good feeling, that everything must be good. But that's the tragedy if you look at the fisherman example. Because of the past karma of killing, pleasant feelings come. So naturally, whatever gives you pleasant feelings, attachment will then make it look delicious. So, and you, then you're addicted to doing it. Then good feelings are not the criterion of valid happiness at all. Whereas on the other hand, you're working on your mind, you're seeing the problems, you're interpreting them properly, you're rejoicing in your suffering, or doing your purification. It's like you're pulling out the weeds. You'll be happy. Intellectually, you'll be happy. You mightn't have a happy feeling, but you'll be happy in your mind. You mightn't have a happy feeling when you come home from the gym. You're full of pain, but your mind interprets it as good, and that's the happiness. Do you see what I'm saying? We're addicted to a pleasant feeling. So if that's true, when you come home from the gym, you should be depressed, but you're not, because it proves the point. There's a distinction between the physical experience of feeling and the interpretation. Do you understand what I'm saying? We've got to really be skillful with our minds and be intelligent with ourselves, you know, and not follow our feelings. We're like babies. This is very powerful, I tell you. Have a break. We've got to finish at 6:30 anyway. I'm getting confused again. Saturday. Sorry, I'm Saturday. I'm pretty wrong. I'm spacing out. Have a break anyway. we'll come back soon. Have a half an hour.
I'm sure we can send something.